One of the first reasons we decided to be an underwriter with NHPR was because we were listeners ourselves.
Kate Morneau of Morneau Law is a proud NHPR underwriter.
Morneau Law's values are completely aligned with NHPR's values. We are focused on the community, giving back to the community, and it's really a natural fit.
You too can join our statewide community of local business supporters. Learn more at nhpr.org/underwrite.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. New Hampshire's coronavirus infections are spiking, and that's likely to continue as people head indoors and gather for the holidays, despite official pleas not to do so. Meanwhile, more states are passing mask mandates for indoor public spaces. At this point, only 13 states don't have these, including New Hampshire. Today in The Exchange, our state's top public health doctors are here on getting through this pandemic winter, including indoor events, masks, testing, contact tracing, vaccines, and new guidance around quarantine. Listeners, what questions do you want to ask our epidemiologists today? Give us a call, 800-892-6477, 800-892-6477, or email exchange@nhpr.org. Our guests are Dr. Benjamin Chan, he's the state's epidemiologist, along with Dr. Elizabeth Talbot, the deputy epidemiologist, and an infectious disease specialist at Dartmouth-Hitchcock Medical Center. Well, welcome back, both of you. Thank you very much for your time, especially at this moment when we do see infections going up. And Dr. Chan, I'd like to just start with an update on a few key numbers that I think will give us a good sense of where we stand. What's the positivity rate at this point, Dr. Chan, meaning of all the people who get tested, what percentage test positive?
Yeah, so that the test positivity rate is one of the measures that we look at to gauge the level of community transmission and whether our testing is able to adequately pick up infections, given the widespread nature of, you know, spread of COVID-19 in our community. And so our current sort of seven-day average PCR test positivity rate stands at about 3.5%. Now, compared to other locations around the U.S. that are, you know, 10-15+%, that remains relatively low. But if you look at the trajectory or the trend of that and other numbers over the last several weeks, it's going up. You know, our test positivity rate used to be less than 1%, so on the order of half of a percent to 1%, and now we're at 3.5%. So that number, as with other measures, has shown a continual increase over the last number of weeks.
Well, I also wonder, Dr. Chan, when you talk about the positivity rate from testing, how good that testing data is, because New Hampshire has the lowest testing rate per 1,000 residents in New England, according to Johns Hopkins. So I wonder what we would find if we tested more people.
Yeah, so New Hampshire's ability to test is actually quite good. You know, on any given day, I think the state is testing maybe close to 8,000 people using PCR tests. Those numbers are not always reflected in external websites, and so I guess we would probably recommend or point people to the New Hampshire data websites with and our testing data there, but we're doing a pretty good job in terms of rolling out testing and making testing available to the citizens of our state.
Oh, okay. Because our website does have all that data as well. So I was looking at the Johns Hopkins site, which has been pretty heavily cited, Dr. Chan, as I'm sure you know. New Hampshire at 5.2 tests per 1,000 people, whereas you've got Vermont at 7.4. and Massachusetts at 11.6. So you're saying Johns Hopkins is not gathering all the data?
Yeah, so one of the pieces of information that we include in our data that's not captured, perhaps, and I haven't looked at the Johns Hopkins website in terms of their testing data recently, but they don't capture, for example, I don't believe, the large amounts of testing that some of our colleges and universities like UNH is doing. And there's various reasons for that, but we do capture those numbers in our test data. And I should also point out that when we talk about a test positivity rate, we're talking about a PCR test positivity rate. We are working on making the antigen testing data also available and included in those numbers. So generally, when if people are looking for the most up-to-date information, we would point people to our website, because there are going to be changes coming in the future.
Sure, and more people are getting that rapid antigen test, as you mentioned. So that's interesting that that's not yet included in those overall numbers. Dr. Talbot, the message that we're getting here in New Hampshire from public health officials like you and Dr. Chan and nationwide is that the main way this virus is now spreading, Dr. Talbot, is through small gatherings. What kind of gatherings are we talking about, Dr. Talbot, and how is this different from the first wave of the virus that we saw in the spring?
You're exactly right, Laura, that there are emerging evidence across the nation and even in New Hampshire that it is small household gatherings that are serving to perpetuate this. That's not surprising as our community transmission rises. I have to say I'm particularly focused on what's coming to us, which is our treasured holidays, Thanksgiving and Christmas for many, that is also going to invite these household gatherings and particularly bring people from out of our region, and some people will have taken appropriate advice regarding safe behaviors at home before arriving, but maybe exposed during travel. And then the various ways that we can make any home gathering safer. I just really hope that we all can make the sacrifices that are going to be necessary this holiday season.
I read something pretty dramatic, Dr. Talbot, this morning. I was reading a lot about Thanksgiving and a lot of people saying, just don't do it. other people saying, here's a couple ways you can make it safer. Somebody said, if you have a big Thanksgiving celebration in November, you might have, you know, Christmas funerals in December. I mean, is it that dire, Dr. Talbot?
You know, deep sigh, I believe it is. I think that what we know of the rising rates and now the rising hospitalizations and even the signal we have that deaths are increasing and ICU admissions, events at long-term care facilities, all metrics are not favorable right now for having a gathering in your home. So we have to be creative in the ways that we celebrate this season. And I do think that the the impact of these events will be seen. We are in a really tough place. We want life as normal. We derive tremendous comfort from gathering with our friends and families in these treasured holidays, and yet this season is not the season for those in traditional ways.
A sober message, and we'll get in a moment to some of the good news around vaccines. But let's go to our listeners, both of you. Bob is calling from Concord. Hi, Bob, you're on the air. Welcome.
Yes, thank you for taking my question.
Sure.
I'm a retired physician in Concord, and I just have a question about the lack of a mask mandate in New Hampshire. You know, as fellow healthcare professionals, given the science and data that support masks, I can't understand the justification for this and why the disparities with our neighboring states, you know, especially when Dr. Fauci yesterday reaffirmed the need for a uniform approach to COVID rather than a disjointed statewide approach.
Bob, thank you for calling in. And Dr. Chan, every time we have you on, we do get questions about this. New Hampshire is one of only 13 states now that does not have a statewide mask mandate. And our caller is right, the only one in New England without one. At what point, Dr. Chan, do you, as the governor's chief public health advisor, say, look, the data is just too compelling and we need to do this?
Yeah, so these are conversations we're having with an ongoing basis. But I do want to mention that, you know, I think Bob makes an important point, and that the CDC just released last week a new scientific brief or scientific memo talking about the data and the efficacy of mask use, and that people wearing masks can, you know, potentially limit community transmission by on the order of 70% to 80%. Like, that's huge. That can be a potential game changer if everybody were to wear a mask. And so we, public health, continue to recommend that everybody, if they're going to step out of their house into public settings, wear a face mask over their mouth and nose as one of the layers to prevent COVID-19 from spreading within our community. That continues to be our recommendation. We continue to emphasize the importance of face masks, especially now when we're seeing all communities throughout the entire state and surrounding states at a substantial or very high level of community transmission. This is how we are going to get control of this pandemic and be able to return to a more normal lifestyle, is by controlling community transmission. And one of the ways that we do that is through implementing not only social distancing, not only good hand hygiene practices, not only avoiding crowds and social gatherings, as Dr. Talbot was just mentioning, but face masks are an important and crucial component of that. And public health continues to stress their importance and recommend that everybody wear them when going out of their house into public locations. And I believe Dr. Talbot wants to follow that up with a comment.
Yeah, go ahead. And I'm just wondering, you know, Dr. Talbot, given those metrics that you gave us a moment ago, you know, the hospitalizations, the deaths, and so forth, at what point does that data become compelling enough where New Hampshire says, okay, here we go?
We've been laser focused since the very beginning of this epidemic and pandemic that masks are important in control, just as Dr. Chan reviewed. We're getting more and more data. It's all consistent. So whether there's a statute or not, I think every listener, every person needs to have those talking points that are going to enable us as a community, as a state, to embrace this. So I'd like to follow that there's an additional bit of data that these masks are not only effective in preventing disease from the wearer to the person in proximity, but the other way around as well. So we've always said, my mask protects you, but now we have data, my mask protects us both, right? So that, I think, if you weren't motivated by protecting the people around you, you know, I hope that you'll hear the benefit is beyond that. So not all masks are created equal. You know, we want people to be wearing the multi-layer masks with densely woven material rather than single layer with low thread count kind of thing. But please do take a look at that CDC website. It's one of the most exciting things I've seen as we've been, again, saying this from day one. We're getting more and more consistent evidence that this is where we need to land.
Got a couple questions coming in on Facebook and email, and I want to encourage listeners, again, you can write to us by email, exchange@nhpr.org, or use Facebook or Twitter or call, as Bob did. It's 800-892-6477. Dr. Talbot, I have a couple questions from people who want to know about gatherings. One person wrote in, some leaders in the state legislature are talking about doing in-person sessions at the State House as soon as January. Do your guests think that's a good idea? And then Glenn in Kingston has a similar question, Dr. Talbot. He says, with community spread now prevalent across New Hampshire, what are your guests' recommendations for local boards and committees regarding in-person versus remote meetings? So, Dr. Talbot, how would you advise these community and political bodies that want to meet in person?
Certainly recognizing the impulse to do so. In-person meetings can be more effective. It's the way we as humans interact, right? I mean, this is all the urge to get back to normalcy. But I think we're all recognizing that you can get a lot done on virtual platforms, especially when you do them, you know, with your camera on and with good audio visual, et cetera. So together, we're all learning how to weigh the continuum of risk. So if you are compelled to have an in-person meeting, then we would suggest screening in place, you know, that you don't go if you're sick, that you adhere to what we've just talked about for masks, that you make hand hygiene an enabled, natural, normal process, that we forego hand shaking, that we are situated at least 6 feet apart, that we increase circulation of air in the setting. You know, crank the windows open if the weather permits, not today probably, but you see, this is a package of interventions that's intended to create safety if you must meet in person. But I think the first step is maybe asking whether this meeting should be remote. I think Dr. Chan wants to follow on that.
Go ahead, Dr. Chan. Yeah.
Yeah, so putting this a different way, you know, don't do it if you don't have to.
Yeah.
you know, I think most of the time meetings can be conducted remotely. You know, we have the technology platforms. There's even free access to these technology platforms. There are risks, especially as community transmission is surging across the state. There are significant risks to meeting in person, right? This is how the virus spreads. So we absolutely encourage people to look at ways to conduct meetings and to conduct business without in-person meetings. Now, there may be circumstances where, you know, people want to meet in person or need to meet in person. And then we go back to, I think, what Dr. Talbot was talking about in terms of the steps, the package of interventions that people can look at to minimize the risk, but the risks are still there. And the other thing I would add to what Dr. Talbot said is that even if people are meeting in a space where they're able to distance by 6 feet or more, we still recommend and encourage mask use in those settings, even if people are separated by 6 feet or more as an extra layer of protection. But absolutely the safest way to conduct meetings and what we recommend is for people to meet remotely.
And wow. Go ahead, Dr. Talbot.
I just can't resist to follow on this important topic. It's a question we get so often. And if you go forward with your in-person meeting, I strongly believe there are people who shouldn't attend. You know, that there are those at the extremes of age and that there are people with underlying medical conditions for whom this decision is not valid. So even if your institution, your community is going forward with an in-person meeting, I think you need to have that discussion with your trusted healthcare provider to know whether you might be that person this virus is going to preferentially harm.
Well, and the state legislature definitely skews older, so that would be a lot of people, Dr. Talbot, who would be in that considered high-risk category. Let's go back to our listeners, and on the phone is Nick in Portsmouth. Hi, Nick. Thanks for calling in today. Go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for having me, and I'm sure. Really happy to have the panelists here to talk to our community about what's going on. My question was regarding testing. Hearing the number around 8,000, looking at the dashboard on the NH.gov site, it says it's around, you know, 6,500 tests per day, but 3,000 tests or more were done at UNH. So that leaves only 3,000 to 4,000 tests for the rest of the state. Is that enough? All the indications I've seen is that the more testing that can be done, the better we have the ability to track and trace. So I was wondering if there's any discussion on increasing testing or making it more widely available. Thanks.
Nick, I'm so glad you called. This is such a good question, both in terms of the specifics, Dr. Chan, how do the UNH numbers figure into our testing numbers overall? And more specifically, more broadly, how much testing is or isn't available? So go ahead, Dr. Chan, on that first question first. We get that a lot.
And that's a great question from Nick, and he's absolutely right that UNH is doing an incredible amount of testing to protect their student body, and I think they've done a pretty phenomenal job at that. On the order of, you know, sometimes they're testing double state numbers. I guess a couple comments to Nick's question, though, is that, one, those numbers don't take into account the antigen testing that is being conducted around the state and is being conducted in increasing numbers. So the actual amount of testing that's being done, especially in outpatient locations, is likely much higher than the PCR test numbers alone show. Again, we're working to try and get those numbers more publicly available so that people can see the reality, I think, of how much testing is being conducted. But I think testing has been one of the successes that we've had in the state in terms of making testing available. You know, obviously we can't make somebody go get tested in the community, but testing remains available for anybody that wants it, whether they have symptoms or not. The other point that I would make about increasing testing is that, yes, absolutely, we are looking at trying to roll out additional testing resources into the community, specifically some of these antigen testing resources like the BinaX Now test cards that people may have been hearing about. We are getting supplies of these from the federal government, and we are looking to distribute them to locations where they can be most highly and appropriately used. There are limitations with these antigen tests compared with the, you know, gold standard PCR test, if you will, but they can serve an important purpose and be used appropriately when they're targeted, I think, to the outpatient setting for people with symptoms.
Well, we got a question about that from James. And so, Nick, I'm glad you called. And James, thank you for writing. James says, my question for the doctors is this. I've seen conflicting recommendations about testing. The CDC seems to suggest everyday people only get tested if they have symptoms or were exposed to a confirmed case. But I've seen many states, including New Hampshire, saying anyone who wants to get tested should get tested. What is the recommendation for testing, James asks. Is it possible that as cases rise, shortages of tests could occur? James, this is a really important question. And Dr. Chan, one that I have had as well, given that we know this virus is about 40% asymptomatic or pre-symptomatic. So that says to me, you would want to test everybody. So what are the recommendations, Dr. Chan?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. I think that there's an intersection here of two different points. One is who to test, and the second is what testing technology do you use? And I think what you're going to see is more information likely coming out from federal authorities like the CDC in the near future around implementing different testing strategies to screen people in the population for asymptomatic infection. That's infection when somebody doesn't have symptoms, which we know can happen. Especially given the rising community transmission across the country. So there absolutely is a role for doing population-level screening and testing. We've seen this be effective in other countries that have managed to limit or eliminate in-country transmission. So thinking about countries and geographic areas like Taiwan and, you know, Japan and some of these other countries, New Zealand, Australia, that have very effectively limited community spread in their countries and in their areas. So there absolutely is a role for doing population-based testing, even if somebody is asymptomatic. But you have to use, I think, the right test. And when you look at antigen tests, they are most accurate when used in people with symptoms. And,
sure.
You know, these tests were rolled out, and I think we're still learning about them. We're seeing new data, which suggests lower accuracy in people without symptoms. And so when it comes to, you know, testing or screening people that don't have symptoms, we continue to recommend the PCR tests, which remain available across the state, and are looking to target these antigen-based tests really more for people that have symptoms, which maximizes the benefit of them and minimizes the risks of false negatives and false positives.
All right. And after a short break, I've got a couple more questions about what you call sort of population testing people who don't have symptoms, how widely available that testing is. But also, I do want to ask both of you about vaccines, how you feel about these developments we've been hearing about, and what the plan is for how these might be distributed here in the Granite State. Lots of listener questions, too. So we will be right back. We're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll read more of your emails at exchange@nhpr.org and take more of your calls. 1-800-892-6477. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, we're talking with the state's top public health doctors about the surge in coronavirus infections in New Hampshire and recent weeks and what officials are calling community spread. The governor and public health officials are urging Granite Staters to avoid small gatherings with family and friends outside of their immediate home group, saying it's these social events that are driving the spike that we're seeing. Listeners, we welcome your questions about testing, about vaccines, about contact tracing, or just more broadly about how this virus behaves. Our phone number is 1-800-892-6477. And our email is exchange@nhpr.org. You can use Facebook or Twitter, too, if you'd like. And Dr. Talbot, I want to share two emails with you that both have to do with sort of skepticism that the virus is as bad as people hear that it is. So Maurice writes on Facebook, hospitals get paid extra money for each COVID-19 case they handle. You have a heart attack, they attribute it to COVID-19, no matter what. Maurice says the bonus system is in place and they instill fear. And Donna has sort of a related question. Will influenza deaths be labeled as COVID deaths? Why so many cases of COVID-19 but fewer deaths? That's actually a separate question that I'd like to ask. But what about that skepticism, Dr. Talbot, that it's not as bad as you and Dr. Chan make it out to be?
I think anyone who's doubting the reality of this pandemic need talk to their trusted healthcare provider. Any healthcare provider who's on these front lines will validate what we're saying, that we are seeing those patients who suffer and die with this infection. So it's hard to talk folk into fixed beliefs where they've received rumors and misinformation and such, but we can speak to the reality on the clinical front lines and the tracking of this virus that we're doing with every ethical and equitable principle in place. Dr. Chan?
Yeah, if I can just follow that up, that, you know, I don't think there's any hospital in the state or around the country or even many healthcare providers that would talk about COVID-19 being a good thing or something that's been beneficial for their business, right? I mean, hospitals are losing money throughout this pandemic. Hospitals
right.
are stretched thin. Some are potentially on the verge of bankruptcy. And so from a business standpoint, I don't agree with the comment. I don't think it speaks to the reality of the situation. And as Dr. Talbot mentioned, I'm not aware of, you know, any providers that think that COVID-19 is some sort of hoax.
Absolutely.
I wonder, Dr. Chan, if Maurice feels that way, because we have heard about, you know, lots of CARES Act money going to hospitals. Maybe that's where the skepticism comes from. Dr. Chan, what do you think?
Yeah, you know, so certainly when we're looking at controlling this pandemic, there are steps that we have needed to take, especially early on in the pandemic, which has had a real financial impact. And the federal government realized this. You know, the state governments have needed the support to be able to maintain business operations, including healthcare. And that's where a lot of the, you know, federal financial support has gone, was to be able to maintain and support businesses through the very difficult financial time that they're having trying to respond to this pandemic.
Well, let's take another call. Maurice and Donna, thank you for writing. And Chris is in Ware. Go ahead, Chris, you're on the air. Welcome.
Good morning. My question is about the safety of hair salons and barbershops. And
sure.
whether there's going to be any additional protocol for those.
And how do you feel about barbershops and hair salons, Chris?
Well, I have an appointment tomorrow.
Uh-huh.
I might say it's a single-person salon with a huge space and a high ceiling, and I trust him. He's careful because it's his livelihood, and he wants to keep it open and safe.
Sure. He doesn't want to be the guy who was known for creating a COVID cluster. And this is interesting, Chris. I'm glad you called. And Dr. Talbot, this shows the level of granular detail in terms of the decision making that people have to make. And boy, it's tiring sometimes. You just want to go get your hair done and not even think about it. But I like the way Chris describes the way her person does it. One person, solo practitioner, big room. Are some hair salons, Dr. Talbot, sort of safer than others?
Yes, absolutely. I love the CDC publication showing that in a setting with two hairdressers who both had COVID-19 during their infectious period, there were no transmissions because they were wearing masks.
Wow.
So they're universal mask wearing. And Chris has indeed raised some of the ways that we can take on these activities of daily life with greater safety and confidence, and that is through mask wearing, through open spacing, through 6 feet apart. Of course, you can't do that with your hairdresser, but from the other people in the waiting area or chair to chair. So same principles, and it is exhausting taking these decisions
yeah.
on a daily basis.
But I'm struck by what you said, Dr. Talbot, and let me make sure I have it right. There were two hairdressers, both of whom actually had COVID, but they did not transmit it to their clients because they were masked.
That's exactly right. So this has been heavily promoted by CDC to let us know that there are safe ways to try to do this. I mean, obviously, we don't want anyone working sick or working with infection. But when this happened in the South, in the Southern state, there were 139 clients exposed to two symptomatic hairstylists, and there were no symptomatic secondary cases identified. So a number of these who were asymptomatic even tested and were found to be negative. So again, the importance of masking, like it's, again, consistent messaging, no doubt about it. Let's do it.
Well, here's the question then, Dr. Talbot, and I'll preface it by saying I live in Concord, which has a mask mandate. So in my own sort of personal world, I see just about everybody wearing masks. So then I wonder, why are we seeing such high rates of transmission, the community spread that you and Dr. Chan talked about, Dr. Talbot? If most Granite Staters are wearing those masks at the hairdresser and the grocery store and so forth, why are we seeing this spread that you guys talked about earlier, Dr. Talbot?
We can circle back to what you said in your opening remarks, that it's likely the small gatherings where we let down our guard, where we let down our mask, right? That if we are seeing our friends and family or our neighbors, you know, that we don't always adhere to this. It just feels too unnatural. Whereas for strangers on the street of Concord, it's easier to implement. So we just need to encourage and enable one another to take this next step and recognize that transmission can happen in household gatherings as well, or in social events that we have previously seen as safe, but in this pandemic era are not.
And we can't gather with family and friends really outside as easily as we did this summer. It was a nice, warm, dry summer, and that option is going away, it seems. Let's go back to the phones, and Kate in Lee is calling in. Hi, Kate. Welcome to The Exchange. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Good morning. How are you?
Good.
Good. Well, my question is about the holidays coming up, and with all of the, you know, warnings about staying away from social gathering, we totally understand that. But I'm wondering if there's any safe way that we could possibly, you know, our very, very small family get together of five people, if we were all able to test ahead of time and stay together inside, is there any safe way that we could do that for this Thanksgiving?
Dr. Chan, this is a great question that I know a lot of people are asking. You know, if I'm very careful right before Thanksgiving, if I get a negative test right before Thanksgiving, can I go to grandma's house? Kate, thank you for calling. And Dr. Chan, what do you think?
Yeah, and I think there's several components to that question. And I think the bottom line is that there are ways that you can try to minimize the risk, but not completely eliminate the risk. And for that reason, especially as community spread is increasing, you know, the recommendation is to avoid gathering with people outside of your immediate household for the holidays, because of the risk that that poses. Now, we have to be realists also and recognize that people likely will get together with family, and family and friends. And so there are steps that people can take to minimize the risks. You know, one of the first steps would be to minimize the size of people at your gathering, right? We're frequently asked, well, is there a certain, you know, size of group at which point, you know, there's a risk and then below which there's not a risk? Like, no, it's all increasing risk. So the more people you have at a gathering, the higher the risk is going to be, partly because there's increased risk that somebody's going to have COVID as you bring more people together. And then also as you have more people being brought together, the chance of, you know, close contact increases. But even if there's a small gathering of, you know, family, friends, you know, we continue to recommend that people stay 6 feet away from others who aren't part of your household. We continue to, you know, stress mask use, even in the indoor setting, you know, washing hands, trying to find ways to eat and socialize that don't require, you know, sharing utensils. And so, for example, if people are going to be gathering around a Thanksgiving meal, trying to assign one person to be dishing out the meals and the plates so that not everybody's grabbing, you know, the shared, you know, serving spoon, for example. You know, so I think there are steps that people can take to minimize the risk, but it's not going to completely eliminate it. And for that reason, we continue to stress and recommend that people avoid gathering with people outside of their immediate household. It's a tough decision. You know, we're 9 months into this pandemic in New Hampshire. Everybody's getting tired of it. But we have to make the hard choices sometimes.
Well, and Dr. Talbot, I know you've got something you want to say here about, you know, it's painful to say, no, we're not doing this. But given that we have some very promising vaccines on the horizon, you know, maybe that gives people hope that they can have Thanksgiving in June. So go ahead, Dr. Talbot, if you could fold in that vaccine message, which is hopeful, to this very sort of grim message that we're hearing, don't do Thanksgiving.
A wonderful opportunity, thank you, because I sometimes feel like we're in this no mode.
Right.
But we have some really good news coming from us, from Pfizer and Moderna. I'm sure you can't have helped but see the headlines for it, that these vaccine candidates have likely exceeded our expectations. Pfizer, even just this morning, has updated that oft-quoted 90% efficacy to 95%. So there's great news in this. This is the first time the mRNA vaccine technology has been demonstrated to be effective in humans. And I think that the consistency of these numbers between Pfizer and Moderna give me greater confidence that this is likely the reality, that this technology works. I love what they've done in terms of making sure they've included racially and ethnically diverse populations and those who are most likely to get sick and even die from this infection, those who are older, those who are with medical comorbidities. And there is absolutely no safety signal, no nothing that looks dangerous about this vaccine in the tens of thousands of people who have now received it. We will continue to dig into this data and make sure that we know everything that we possibly can about it as we turn our attention to mechanisms to equitably, efficiently, and effectively distribute this vaccine to people who need it in New Hampshire.
So to Kate, Dr. Talbot, you know, wondering if there's a safe way to gather, what's the message? Hold off or give it a try, but it's not risk-free? Because I know a lot of listeners have this question right now. Should I bother or should I just wait?
So as a clinician, I have patients asking me these questions on a very regular basis.
I'm sure.
You know, my patients help inform some of the messaging that I'd like to give right now. And again, it's an intersection of who you are. That is, if you have medical comorbidity, if you're sick with diabetes or heart disease, if you're older than 65, then I think the answer is that no, that you need to embrace the virtual ways of celebrating this holiday. If you go forward, as described, there are behaviors before going, during your travel, and then while you're in your event that can make things safer, as discussed. I myself hear very often the question that Kate had regarding the role of testing in creating safety at these events.
Right.
And it's contributory, but not definite. So remember how incubation is 14 days. So if you're exposed, you have 14 days during which you might become infectious and the tests pick you up, detect you. So if you test just before that's going to happen, you might still be contagious at the event. So the testing is helpful for some confidence, but not perfect security. I also want to warn folks that a lot of the transmission that happens during travel is at the bus stations, at the train stations, at the public transport, like the shuttles, at the airports, at the gas stations and the rest stops, and et cetera. So even if you quarantine at home before coming to your event, and you even test, you might pick up the virus on the way. So again, you've heard me often enough. I am that Debbie Downer. I think that it's better to skip Thanksgiving this year so that you can have Thanksgiving next year.
So skip it this year so you can have it next year.
Yeah. And I would also add to that, like, we're not just talking about travel out of New Hampshire or out of New England. Even gathering, you know, with other people, family that are in New England or in New Hampshire poses risk. You know, I myself have family in New Hampshire, and we are making the difficult decision of foregoing family gatherings this year because of the pandemic. You know, and so we're trying to, I think, all do our best to, you know, limit, control spread of this virus. And it's the social gatherings that are really going to be driving this virus and the transmission in our community.
We have to take a very quick break, but when we come back, I do want to ask about contact tracing and how that has changed. I also have a couple more questions from listeners about the home COVID testing kit, and also familiar questions about whether you can get COVID from touching surfaces. I know this comes up a lot. So we will be right back. Thank you, everyone, for calling. Keep your calls coming in. We've still got time to take them. 800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org, and we will be right back. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, we're talking with the state's top public health doctors about the coronavirus pandemic in New Hampshire this winter as the state's infections sharply rise. Our guests are Dr. Benjamin Chan, he's the state epidemiologist, and Dr. Elizabeth Talbot, the deputy epidemiologist and an infectious disease specialist at Dartmouth-Hitchcock. You can join us 1-800-892-6477 or email exchange@nhpr.org. And both of you, I want to start this segment with an email from John, who says, could you and your guests address the cutback of contact tracing? Is this just a financial decision? If money was provided by the state or federal government, would it be worth doing in spite of the difficulty? And John, thank you for writing. And Dr. Chan, go ahead, please.
Yeah, so that's a great question from John. And let me start by saying that contact tracing is an important part of one of the layers, the package of interventions to control community transmission. But as we get to such high, widespread levels of community transmission, the effectiveness of contact tracing is diminished, right? And why do I say that? Contact tracing is a containment strategy, right? We look to identify and track down and break chains of transmission. And when numbers are low and community transmission is low, we're much more effective and able to contain the virus through contact tracing. But when we get to such high levels of community transmission throughout the state, the effectiveness of using that as a primary strategy is greatly diminished. And at that point, we really need to rely on the what we call non-pharmaceutical interventions, the community mitigation strategies, the social distancing, the face mask use, the hand hygiene, avoiding social gatherings. That is what's going to bring the numbers back down and bring community transmission back under control. So it's not that we're not doing contact tracing. We still are. We are just prioritizing it to those settings where it's going to be most impactful and most useful, such as institutional settings, whether that's healthcare agencies, long-term care facilities, schools. We are still investigating people that have been in, you know, many of these areas with COVID-19. But at a community-wide level, it becomes less effective the higher the rates go with spread of COVID-19.
So a lot of the experts that I read, Dr. Chan, say contact tracing is a good way to contain the virus. But if you're going to scale it back, it needs to be mitigated with other measures like masking, like restrictions on gatherings and so forth. So given the pullback in contact tracing, is that on the way for New Hampshire? Other restrictions that take a different tack?
Yeah, so again, we continue to stress all of these interventions as being important. You know, testing also is another measure or a step that people can take to help identify infection early, even asymptomatic infection. And you know, I think as we said earlier, we're in continual discussion about how to best control this virus, and we will continue to work with all of our community partners who are on the front lines to work with them to help mitigate this, you know, from the healthcare providers to the businesses to the schools, and we'll continue to advise, you know, leadership in New Hampshire and even nationally on steps that we need to take to bring this pandemic under control.
In terms of contact tracing, you know, as you said at the press conference last week, your office is still going to do contact tracing for sort of higher risk groups, members of minority groups who've been harder hit, people in institutional settings and so forth. But for the other groups, Dr. Chan, I believe Health and Human Services Commissioner Lori Chibonet said health providers would be involved. They'd be, quote, given the tools to tell those who test positive more information about quarantine and isolation. So is it the doctor's offices that are going to do the contact tracing now, Dr. Chan? Is it the individual who has to call other contacts? I'm just not sure who's going to do it if you guys aren't doing it.
Yeah, good question. So the healthcare providers, we are not expecting to themselves do the contact tracing. What we have asked healthcare providers to do is connect patients that they might diagnose with COVID-19 or that they care for with COVID-19 to the resources for those individuals to help with the notification at the community level. I would point people to our website, nh.gov/COVID-19. And right at the top of the page are two links, self-quarantine guidance and self-isolation guidance. These are documents that have been updated specifically for this purpose to give people who are infected themselves with COVID-19 or people that may have been exposed to COVID-19 and are close contacts further information and further guidance on steps that they can and should take to help us control spread of COVID-19 within the community. And that's going to involve people that are diagnosed with COVID-19 helping to notify their friends and family and other people that they may have been in contact with about a potential exposure. Certainly, if people are concerned or have questions, they can always reach out to us at Public Health. But we have made these documents available on our website to give more guidance, and we have asked healthcare providers to help connect their patients with the same information.
Oh, wow. So, Dr. Chan, just to make sure I have it right. So if I came down with COVID-19, I would have to do my own contact tracing? I would have to call, you know, whatever store I happen to be at or whatever person I happen to see? It's up to me to do it?
So in some settings, you know, we are asking individuals to notify their friends and family who they have been in close, prolonged contact with. So, you know, we're not talking about the casual interaction at the grocery store. And if there's a potential large exposure to the public, you know, public health would get involved. It would get involved and assist with that contact tracing. But in terms of the question, will everybody diagnosed with COVID-19 get a call from public health? The answer now is not necessarily. And in that setting, we would rely on the individual to help notify their family and friends of potential exposure.
I want to go back to our listeners and go to an email from Sarah in Portsmouth who says, once someone has tested positive for COVID and recovered, are they considered safe contacts for those that haven't had the infection? Sarah, this is a question so many people have. And Dr. Talbot, I'm guessing it's a question you get a lot.
It is. And I wish I had the answer for it.
We don't know. Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you what I do know. And that is that people can become reinfected. This was some very bad news we had several months ago, where there was very clear evidence that this virus doesn't result in lifelong immunity to this infection. So that's to say a person remains at risk. We know that within 3 months of that previous infection, a person will have the lowest risk of reinfection. So some of our guidance to persons who are re-exposed, take that into account. But in general, we're still on a continuum of risk. So even if you've had COVID-19 back in March, we are letting you know that the emerging science says that this may not render you immune to the virus for life. So again, I wish it were different, and it's not. That's why we're watching very closely that the vaccine appears to have a much higher immune response than even natural infection. So we may get additional duration of protection following vaccination than we do from natural infection.
Got a couple more emails that I'd love to get to before we close out. And both Katie and Kate write about bubbles and people, you know, trying to get through the winter by staying indoors with at least a couple other people beyond their immediate family. Katie says, how do you define a safe bubble or pod? Should you have to wear a mask inside your bubble? What about sharing meals? That's from Katie. And then Kate has a more specific question about is there a way to stay safe with childcare at this time? Kate says, I have a 17-month-old son whom my 70-year-old parents watch several times a week at their home. Our family has had no close contact for 6 months during the beginning of the pandemic, but decided to become a bubble together. Now, with cases on the rise, I'm wondering if it's worth the risk, mainly to my older parents, to continue this practice. My husband works at Trader Joe's, so that adds another level of worry. We are all very cautious and always wear masks. And I shop at Trader Joe's, and she's right. Everybody at Trader Joe's wears a mask, so that's good. Kate and Katie, thank you for writing. And both of you, I'd love your broad thoughts just on creating a safe bubble. And I'm sure lots of people have struggles like Kate. You know, you need the childcare. So, Dr. Chan, can you go first on that, please?
Yeah, and you know, creating a bubble or a pod, and you know, these go by different terms, you know, is one way to look at how we can balance the need to interact with one another, to socialize, you know, occasionally, with trying to control the pandemic, right? So how do you define a pod or a bubble? Well, you know, I think it's the fewer the number of people, the better, right? Going back to this idea of, you know, trying to limit the number of people that you might come into close contact with. And at the end of the day, you have to be able to trust the people that you're going to create a pod or a bubble with, that they're taking all the same necessary and appropriate precautions, limiting, you know, going out in public, wearing face masks when they go out in public settings, you know, practicing good hand hygiene, you know, having confidence that if somebody is having symptoms, they're not going to be gathering with you and going to get in, and that they're going to go get tested, for example. So, you know, I think ultimately it comes down to an issue of trust and knowing the people that you're looking at creating a pod or a bubble around or with. But it is a strategy that can be looked at for trying to balance this, you know, need for social interaction with controlling spread of the pandemic.
Yeah, because, you know, there is, and I know this is not your expertise, but there is the psychological wear and tear on people. And, you know, some people are saying the mental health aspects of this are going to be another pandemic. Within that bubble, Dr. Talbot, should Katie wear a mask?
Really good question. I do like the different names that have sprung up for this. I think quarantines is pretty funny.
Yeah.
And it requires that you agree to abide by the same rules. Everybody describes that they are 100% masking in public circumstance, limiting their amount of time, limiting interactions with anyone who's not in that bubble, of course. That's absolutely key. And then what you decide are acceptable rules within your quarantine is whether touching and hugging are okay, whether you take your mask off when you're together. And I think those things are acceptable if you really have that completely adherent pod, quarantine, social bubble. So that's the beauty of it, is I think that it does give us some small community of normalcy, but it has to be done right.
Yeah. Well, two last questions I'd love to get to before we close out. And Dr. Talbot, I'm going to throw this one to you. Mara says, please show studies or evidence that people have caught COVID from touching surfaces. And boy, this comes up a lot, Dr. Talbot. Go ahead.
I'll start with the fact that the majority of infections are spread by respiratory droplets. Like, that's 99-whatever% of what's happening out there. So fixation on the so-called fomites or frequently touched surfaces that may be contaminated is probably diverting your limited energy from the real ways this virus transmits. But that said, we have really no credible evidence for library book, mail, dollar bill transmission, that the investigations that are done globally suggest that this is a tiny role in propagating this infection. And tell you what, hand hygiene will go a long way to helping you avoid any inadvertent fomite self-inoculation. So, you know.
Yeah, and yet there's so much emphasis on cleaning. You know, businesses and schools are saying, look at our cleaning protocols, and we're shutting down once a week for cleaning. It makes people think that cleaning is more important than really it is, Dr. Talbot.
Cleaning is important, especially if there are frequently touched surfaces and when children are involved. So it's quite a different thing for children who are mouthing toys or teething or, you know, very likely to shed secretions, if you will, in their environment. So I think the cleaning protocols that are in place are still appropriate. They give people that extra confidence to keep our society rolling. But is there evidence for proof that that is what's stopping transmission? Again, I want to just make sure we're putting our attention where it should be, and that is on avoiding droplet transmission, such as by the mask use and the hand hygiene and the distancing.
Well, and Dr. Chan, I'm going to throw this last one to you, and I apologize. We do not have that much time left, but I think you can answer it quickly. Peggy wants to know, when a vaccine is ready for distribution in New Hampshire, will it be through the regional public health networks?
Yeah, great question. And so we anticipate having potentially some limited supply of the vaccine coming to us from the federal government and manufacturers by the end of December. But that vaccine is going to be first targeted to those who are either at highest risk of severe complications from COVID-19 or those on and or those on the front lines like healthcare providers. So we will likely not see enough vaccine quantities for mass public distribution until sometime next year.
You know, all right. And I'm going to cut you off there, Dr. Chan, but we will pick up on this thread the next time we talk. For now, I really appreciate both of you very much for being with us. And I know we'll talk in a couple weeks. Today's show was produced by Exchange producer Christina Phillips. Thanks for listening to everybody. This is The Exchange on NHPR.